wait a minute, this sounds like rock and or roll.
Hello, welcome to Rock and or Roll. I'm your reluctant host, BJ. Lindsay Adams Buckingham was born on October 3rd, 1949 in the upper middle class suburb of Atherton, California, near Palo Alto, the third and youngest son of Morris and Ruth Buckingham. By the age of 13, Lindsay had become quite interested in folk music and spent hours in his room teaching himself to fingerpick, just like the Kingston Trio. He joined his first group at age 15, and during his senior year in high school formed a band with three other friends, which they christened the Fritz Rabin Memorial Band. According to Lindsay's former bandmate Javier Pacheco, who wrote the majority of the band's original material, Fritz Rabin was a classmate of theirs, a shy German kid, probably the son of immigrants, whose name they just picked out of the blue, and according to Javier, quote, "The poor guy didn't really enjoy the sudden popularity of his name. He moved away and we never heard from him again." Eventually, a singer named Stephanie Nix, who was a year older than the rest of them, joined the band, and the name was shortened to just Fritz. Apparently, Lindsay found it difficult to master the heavy rock style of the band at the time on guitar. His abilities leaned more towards the finger-picking styles of folk and bluegrass, so he was relegated to playing bass most of the time. Fritz were together for 3.5 years and popular on the San Francisco Bay music scene. They opened for Santana, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin. The band broke up in 1971, but Lindsay and Stevie Nicks continued performing together and called themselves Buckingham Nicks. Eventually, with the help of producer Keith Olsen, they got a record deal with Polydor, and an album was released in November of 1973. But the record did not sell. The duo began writing and demoing songs for a second album, but then in late 1974, Mick Fleetwood was checking out potential recording studios in LA, and it was at the legendary Sound City studio where Keith Olsen played Mick the Buckingham Nicks track Frozen Love, just to demonstrate the studio's acoustics.
Thank you.
Mick was impressed with the guitar player on the track, and soon after, when Fleetwood Mac guitarist Bob Welch announced he was leaving the band, Mick sought Lindsey out. Mick was initially interested only in hiring Lindsey, but Lindsey insisted that he and Stevie Nicks were a package deal, and this worked out well for Mick. Fleetwood Mac was a British blues band originally formed in 1969, and by the time Lindsey and Stevie joined, they had already released 9 albums. This would be the band's 10th lineup change, and Lindsey Buckingham would be Fleetwood Mac's 6th guitar player.
Monday morning, you sure look fine.
The first Fleetwood Mac album with Lindsey and Stevie, a self-titled record, was recorded in just 10 days with Keith Olsen at the helm and released in July of 1975. The first single, Over My Head, went top 20, and the album immediately became the band's highest charting record and cracked the top 10 in October of 75, eventually breaking all sales records for Warner Brothers at the time. So that record has since been eclipsed by rumors, but it was a big deal. The album rode up and down the charts for all of 1976, eventually hitting number one in September of 76, more than a year after it had been released. Let's check out a live recording of Lindsey's magnum opus from that self-titled Fleetwood Mac album, a song called I'm So Afraid.
Change. I never will. I'm so afraid the way I feel.
Whereas the self-titled album took 10 days to record, Rumors took many months, up to 10 months to complete, and wouldn't be released until February of 1977. The album debuted at number 10 on the Billboard charts, but eventually made it to number 1, where it stayed for 6 months straight, May through November of 1977. Rumors was either at number 1 or number 2 on the Billboard charts for a total of 10 months straight, from March of 77 to January of 1978. And eventually it has gone on to sell 25 million copies. Lindsey Buckingham's song Go Your Own Way was the first single from the record and went top 10, but it is his acoustic masterpiece Never Going Back Again that blows my mind. One of my favorite songs ever. So how does a band follow up an album as monumental as Rumors? By the time the band convened at Village Recorders in LA in early 1978 to begin recording the follow-up, Rumors had already sold 8 million copies. The pressure to record Rumors Part 2 must have been enormous, both internally and externally. Fleetwood Mac spent 2 years and $1.4 million, which is upwards of $5 million when adjusted for inflation, making what Warner Brothers certainly must have hoped was going to be Rumors 2, but Rumors 2 was not what Lindsey Buckingham had in mind.
There's an axiom in this town, certainly, or perhaps in America, which is if it works, beat it into the ground. And I don't buy that. You know, you've got to, I think you have to be responsible to your own needs as an artist. You've got to be responsible to the work you're doing. You can't shoot for the stardom per se. You've got to shoot for the quality of the work and the growth. And if that means going from a Rumors to something that's going to confound a lot of people's expectations, then so be it.
The Lindsey Buckingham that made Tusk was a very different Lindsey Buckingham from the down-on-his-luck hippie that joined a washed-up British blues band. He was rich and famous, but something else had happened to Lindsey between Rumors and Tusk. Punk rock. He loved The Clash. When Lindsey arrived at the studio closely cropped and clean-shaven, the band must have known right then that they weren't going to be making Rumors too.
But is that awful lot of pressure once you've had a album that big and then you have to make the decisions on what they're going to do in the next album and they all say, well, will this be as big as Rumors?
Well, there's two ways you can go with that. Obviously, something that sells that many copies is a very difficult act to follow from any standpoint. Right. We could have done an album that was very much like Rumors and more or less gone for the money again, gone for the safe route, and it would have we would have gotten a certain amount of flack for, you know, going for the money. We decided that having shown that we could be a commercial band, we would show that we had another side to us as well, which was an experimental, a little more artsy-craftsy side.
Tusk is sort of an infamous flop, but appreciation for the record has grown over time, and Fleetwood Mac are often credited with defying expectations and pursuing art over profit. But 11 of the 20 songs on Tusk were written by either Stevie Nicks or Christine McVie. And while I like most of those songs a lot, they're not very far removed from Rumours. When people call Tusk eclectic or unconventional or experimental, they are talking about the 9 Lindsey Buckingham songs on the record. The rhythm section of Mick Fleetwood and John McVie, one of the greatest rhythm sections of all time, contributed quite a bit to some of Lindsey's songs, but Lindsey did most of the recording on his own. And in essence, what Tusk contains, scattered throughout, is a 9-song Lindsey Buckingham solo album. And that Lindsey Buckingham solo album, contained within Tusk, is perhaps my favorite album of all time. Lindsey's first appearance on the album Tusk is an insane romp called The Ledge. It's the second song on the album, stuck between 2 Christine McVie songs, and it's barely produced, with buried vocals, and must have prompted much head-scratching from anyone looking for Rumours too, but it's a great, great song. Lindsey has one more song on side one of Tusk, a great acoustic ballad called Save Me a Place, which, while certainly not as odd as The Ledge, still contains a bit of weirdness, mainly in the way the word save is stretched out just a little bit too long for comfort on the chorus. Side two of Tusk begins with an amazing Lindsey song called What Makes You Think You're the One. And I'd argue perhaps this should have been the first single from the album, even though it's just quirky enough to probably have made the average top 40 listener in 1979 uncomfortable. Lindsey has 2 more songs on side 2 of Tusk. At position 3, an atmospheric ballad called That's All for Everyone, probably my least favorite of the Lindsey songs here. And then at position 4 of side 2, a great, snarky, up-tempo number called Not That Funny, which was released as a single, but only in the UK. Side 3 of Tusk is where we find my 2 favorite Lindsey Buckingham songs on the album. At position 2, we get That's Enough for Me, which I've described as rockabilly power pop. It's an insanely up-tempo, poppy number, an adrenaline rush, I love it. And then, the last song on side 3 is my favorite song on the album, and one of my very favorite songs of all time. A song called I Know I'm Not Wrong, which for some reason, on the 2004 reissue of the album, was given an insane remix, where all sorts of harmony vocals, not even present on the original, are suddenly omnipresent, suffocating the wonderful melody and completely altering the song, basically ruining it in my opinion. It certainly becomes a different song, and it's inexplicable to me why this was done, but if you want to hear the actual song, I Know I'm Not Wrong, you need the original vinyl, or at least the 1990 CD release. Side 4 of Tusk features 2 more Lindsey songs at positions 3 and 4. Walk a Thin Line is a moody lullaby with twice the Mick Fleetwood goodness. You have to listen to the song with headphones to truly appreciate Mick's double drum tracks. This is a great, great song, and also would have been a much better choice as a single. And speaking of singles, up next, track 4, side 4, is the first single released from the album, a very strange schizophrenic song called Tusk. It's a really cool song, very creative. The song is like nothing else, but that's why it's so insane that they chose to release it as the first single. Obviously, with such an odd song as most people's introduction to the album, excitement for the record would have waned, and sales must have been affected, but Tusk is a really cool song. So what we're going to do right now is we're going to listen to the Lindsey Buckingham album that is buried within the Fleetwood Mac album Tusk. It would have been a very short album, 9 songs, clocking in at 26 minutes, so I've padded it with a really nice cover of the Beach Boys song Farmer's Daughter that was recorded during the Tusk sessions. So that makes it a 10-song album, clocking in at closer to half an hour. Plus, Lindsey put a couple of cover songs on his first solo LP, Law & Order, so it works. So this is the record that Lindsey Buckingham could have released in 1979, and it would probably be my favorite album of all time. I took some liberties sequencing the record myself. I took into account song length and made each side close to the same length. I'll leave a short pause between sides, but in my sequence, the song Tusk would kick off side 2. So give it a listen and imagine this as a Lindsey Buckingham album, released in 1979, because it could have been.
In some ways, I suppose you could say that if you isolated my work on Tusk and pulled it out, it's sort of like my first solo record.
Thank you.
said, stay.
So like I said earlier, the Fleetwood Mac album Tusk, a double album released in 1979, is basically considered a monumental flop, pretty much only because it was following up one of the biggest hit records of all time, Rumours. When Tusk came out, the list price was $15.99, I think, which was very expensive at the time, and Mick Fleetwood always talks about how the night before the album was released, they played the entire thing on Westwood One radio, so people could have just taped it off the radio, and he thinks that affected sales. The music industry was in a slump at the time, and they were freaking out about home taping, and definitely the industry was looking toward Fleetwood Mac to kind of give it a shot in the arm. They were expecting, obviously, the follow-up to Rumours to be a huge album, and even though Tusk sold millions of copies, it didn't even come close to being the kind of success that Rumours was. And compared to Rumours, and considering they were following up Rumours, it was a flop.
I think at some point after the shock of what it really was and how far away it was from being, quote, Rumours 2, hit not only the group in terms of the possible monetary repercussions, but the company as well. I was very pleasantly surprised at how well some of that stuff held up and how it had the sense of explosion and the moment to it, you know.
I've got a few quotes from Lindsay about the record. "Doing a double album didn't make any business sense at all," he said, "but it meant a lot to us artistically, whether we could still feel challenged. We really, really are pleased with it. We've also, I think, got enough discretion to know if the songs aren't up to standard, in which case we'd have just put out a single album." Now, he's really speaking for himself there. That was his vision for the record, and he produced the record. Here's another quote. "I got a lot of support from the band during the making of Tusk. Everyone was really excited about it. Then, when it became apparent that it wasn't going to sell 15 million albums, the attitude started to change, which was sad for me in a way, because it makes me wonder where everyone's priorities are. They changed their attitude about the music after they realized it wasn't going to sell as many copies. That's not really the point of doing it. The point is to shake people's preconceptions about pop." So again, you can see Lindsey Buckingham had a certain vision for Tusk that perhaps wasn't shared by the rest of his bandmates. One last quote from Lindsey about Tusk. "For me, the Tusk album was the most important album we made, but only because it drew a line in the sand that, for me, defined the way I still think today. I was trying to pave some new territory for us, but another way of looking at it is that I was causing trouble. Had we all wanted the same thing for the same reason, I probably never would have made solo albums." ¶¶
know, I was always interested in music, but when my older brother brought home Heartbreak Hotel, as is probably a story that is similar to many others, it was a life-changing event, and suddenly there was music that seemed like it was for us and not for our parents. And I became an obsessive listener of rock and roll. And Elvis's guitarist, Scotty Moore, was someone who played with a pick, but also used his fingers. And he sort of had an orchestral style going. And then later on some of those records, you had Chet Atkins. And both of these people had a very orchestral, integrated technique in terms of how they defined the records that they were making. So that was an early influence in terms of thinking in terms of finger picking. A few years later, when the first wave of rock and roll started to ebb a little bit, I got very interested in folk music. And of course, the three-finger Travis pick is sort of a basic thing that you learn when you get into that. I was also listening to some what you might call classical light, you know, some pop interpretations of classical, which would add the third finger as well, and would also bring in maybe melody lines played within a finger picking structure. I picked up on the banjo because a lot of those groups were playing banjo, so I bought myself some finger picks and was playing bluegrass banjo, and that whole kind of role, which is again three fingers, informs a lot of the things later, like World Turning, songs that are directly connected to that style of playing. So that's really about it in terms of what I can analyze. You know, I am a player who was not taught. I consider myself to be sort of a refined primitive. I'm someone who does not read music. So because I learned by listening to songs and getting a chord book and played songs, it was always about the song. It also makes it difficult for me to analyze it too deeply or too technically. All of those things were, you know, made up the bulk of how I played guitar. Now, when I got into a band after high school, I couldn't play lead. That was not part of my lexicon at all. And so I played bass in that band. And it was only after that band broke up and Stevie Nicks and I started thinking of becoming a duo that I started writing songs and added lead into my range. And, by that time, I was not someone who was going to take to a pick very often. Sometimes in the studio, you know, you use a pick for a specific application. But, the fact that I play lead without a pick is really just an extension of my limitations, I think, if you want to look at it that way. When we joined Fleetwood Mac, Mick tried to get me to start using a pick, and it wasn't going to happen. So, you know, that's just the way it's worked out.
I just need some.
So that's going to do it for The Genius of Lindsey Buckingham Part 1. I hope you enjoyed it. Let me know, rockandorrollpodcast.blogspot.com, rockandorrollpodcast@gmail.com, or find the Rock and or Roll Facebook page. And I hope you're looking forward to Part 2 next week. And now, to play us out.
What does that mean, to play us out? I don't know what that means, to play us out. What does that mean? To end the show?
Yeah.
I'm going to leave you with a live performance of Go Your Own Way, the first single from Rumors. This was recorded for the Old Grey Whistle Test for the BBC in 1976, so this is before Rumors was released, and really not that long after Stevie and Lindsey had broken up and the song had been written about that breakup. And if you watch the video on YouTube, at the very beginning of the song, you can see Stevie glaring at Lindsey. She hates this song, or she hated it at the time. She hated the lyrics. She hated the packing up, shacking up's all you want to do. I know she really hated that line. And toward the end of the song, basically the coda of the song, beginning at about 2:35 or so, you can see Stevie look back at Christine McVie. She seems to be grinning mischievously. And at that point, they intentionally seem to sing You Could Call It Another Lonely Day while Lindsey is singing Go Your Own Way. And Lindsey has to switch. Lindsey has to switch from singing Go Your Own Way to Call It Another Lonely Day. And then for the coda of the song, they end up just singing Call It Another Lonely Day over and over. Basically, it seems because Christine McVie and Stevie Nicks switched it up on Lindsey. And he just had to go along with what they were doing. And you could see Stevie Nicks laughing about it and looking back at Christine. But what a great live performance of the song. Check it out. This is Fleetwood Mac, 1976, Old Grey Whistle Test. Really cool because this is before the song had even been released on Rumors. Rumors wouldn't come out until early 1977. So here we go, The Genius of Lindsey Buckingham, a song called Go Your Own Way. Great live performance.
Loving you isn't the right thing to do. Ever change things that I feel? If I could, maybe I'd give you my world. How can I, when you won't take it from me? You can go your own way, go your own way. You can call it
be back.